You're listening to a DM podcast.
They put me in an induced coma and they did a bit of an operation on my arm right there and then to stop the bleeding as much as they could. And they actually did a little procedure in air where they opened up my groin and moved blood past my broken femur into my lower leg so that I didn't lose my leg.
The center north station of the child where it's 1 on 4 58.
Still breathing okay at the moment.
Is it a big property?
That blood pressure is not coming up.
1 on 4 93, understood, thank you.
Hi, my name is Lana Mitchell from the Royal Flying Doctor Service. This is a podcast about life in the bush, mateship, courage, and the role that the Royal Flying Doctor Service plays in serving rural and remote communities. This is the Flying Doctor Podcast.
My name is Kira Lee Dargan from the Royal Flying Doctor Service, and I'm an Aboriginal woman of the Wiradjuri Nation. This podcast has been recorded on Ngunnawal land and is being broadcast across all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander nations. We at the Royal Flying Doctor Service want to acknowledge elders, past and present. The RFDS recognises that this is First Peoples land and always will be.
One of the reasons I find the creation and ongoing release of the Flying Doctor podcast interviews so fulfilling is that I get to meet some of the most incredible people from all over the country. In my view, Hollywood portrays being human as sort of being vulnerable or weak, an effect of whatever life throws at you. And in Hollywood's projection, it's X-Men and superheroes that save the day with their amazing strength and powers. But my interviews with everyday people from all over this country have shown me that within each and every one of us, there's great strength, courage, and tenacity. We're all superheroes, actually. We just don't always recognize it. As the saying goes, and excuse the language, sometimes shit happens, but it is what we do and how we respond to those challenges that makes all the difference. I'm honored to be chatting to Gail and Mac Shan in this podcast. For those who've not heard of their story, it's been featured on ABC's Australian Story twice, and it's been voted the most popular story by the Australian public. It's obvious why Gail and Mac's story resonates with so many people. Gail endured a life-changing accident many years back, but the attitude of both and the care and respect that they have for each other sees them living a happy and fulfilled life. Hello, Gail and Mac.
Hello, Lana. How are you?
I'm really good. I'm really pleased that we get to have this conversation. I've been a little bit excited about it, actually, all morning.
Yes, well, so are we. And thank you so much for the invitation for us to join your podcast. Royal Flying Doctor is something we're both very passionate about, so it's our pleasure to join you today.
Thank you. Now, Gail, you grew up on a remote cattle station. Could you tell me a little bit about that?
Yes, and we both did. So we both grew up in North Queensland on very isolated cattle properties. And even though we both did school of the air in the same area, we were still really 7 hours apart. But, yeah, life on the cattle station was wonderful. It was hard work, but we had the most wonderful childhood. We did school of the air on our Flying Doctor radio, in fact.
Yeah.
But, yes, we had a childhood that many people wouldn't understand and wouldn't get the honour of fulfilling, as we, Mac and I both did.
Did you end up becoming an expert horsewoman as a result of living on the land and working on the land?
Yes. Yes, we were both very passionate about horses and cattle. It was our life. So we grew up, before school there started and before school finished, we'd be on our horses down in the river, jumping off cliffs into water and all sorts of crazy things. That was the childhood we got to have, and goodness knows where our parents thought we were, because when it wasn't school, we'd be gone all day. I'd put an orange in my saddlebag and off we'd go, and my sisters would cook mussels on a fire. But it was an incredible way to grow up, and it, I think, is a big part of what made us resilient.
Mm. And you too, Mac, would you tell me a little bit about your childhood?
Yeah, so we grew up on the edge of the Burdekin River, sort of 300 kilometres south of where Gail grew up. And once again, it was, you could only imagine this day and age, luckily before phones and before iPads, so everything was outdoors and all sorts of things. And it just, it broadens your horizon so much, whether it be riding a horse, a motorbike, or learning to drive, you know, before you're 10 years old. It's all those things, I think, sort of, I think they actually create early maturity more than anything. You know, you sort of get all that wild stuff out of your system when you're supposed to, when you're small, and then as you get older, you're a little bit more mature, I think.
I do agree. I live on a rural property myself with my kids, and I will admit that I've had my young son sitting doing a little paddock bashing, propped up with three or four pillows, and, you know, we even at one point had to, you know, move the seat so far forward that, you know, just so he could reach the pedals. But it makes such a big difference when kids can learn and extend themselves. And I think when you grow up on a property, particularly when it's a remote property like the two of you have grown up on, it really does build that resilience and independence. Yes. For kids.
Yes. And you know, we were given responsibilities, and like Max said, that's what helps make you grow up a bit earlier, I think. Yeah. I do think resilience is a huge part of it.
Tell me a little bit about the School of the Air. What was that experience like?
So we did correspondence papers. They would come in the mail. Our mail run was once a week, and the mailman used to stay with us every Monday night. And the correspondence papers would come on the mail, and we would have to do them through the week and post them back to Brisbane. But every day we would do a half-hour session on the Flying Doctor Radio to Cairns, it was at that time. It later changed to Charters Towers. But, yeah, they were half-hour on-air lessons where all the other kids were calling in on similar radios, and we had a teacher at the other end. And, yeah, when you wanted to answer a question, you just called your name out as quickly as you could. And, yeah, that was School of the Air.
And so were both of you in the same school, so to speak, or, like, did you ever hear each other on the radio, or were you different classes?
Well, I'm 3 years older than Max, so we were different classes, but all based out of Cairns. And once a year we would have summer schools, I used to call them, where we would go and spend a week with other kids. It was the only time we would ever see other kids. And, yeah, but we didn't really ever cross paths because there was a little age gap.
Yeah. Now, both of your families have a history of breeding cattle, is that right?
That's correct, yes. We're both very passionate about our cattle breeding. My grandfather, Monty Atkinson, so my father's father, developed the Droughtmaster breed. So he formed the society. He implemented getting Boss Indicus cattle into North Queensland because he saw what they could do for tick resistance and just more tropically adapted. So he made inways into getting them into Queensland, and that initially came from the Taronga Park Zoo in Sydney, and that didn't go so well when the cattle died on the boat, and then through the CSIRO a few years later he was able to fulfil his dream and bring them into Queensland and cross them with the European cattle. And over the years he saw a need to form a society, which he did, and he was president for many years, and then that branched off again into individual breed names. So he formed the Droughtmaster breed and named them. So there's a long history within our family of cattle breeding. It's very much in our blood. And I've got to say, Mac is no different to me. He is very passionate about his cattle.
Tell me about your family history in the cattle space, Mac.
Yeah, so we didn't really grow up, you know, significantly under one breed. My father and his father drew a block on the edge of the Burdekin River and moved there, and then, yeah, obviously married to my mother a few years later. So he's a passionate cattleman, been there all his life, and started with a shorthorn-based herd, and then when the Brahmins came in, he started breeding, you know, crossing them over the shorthorns. And then eventually now they've got a sort of a Brahmin Droughtmaster herd, which they, beautiful, beautiful line of cows, yeah.
So did you know from a young age, Mac, that you wanted to follow in similar footsteps, that you wanted to follow a similar path, or were you unsure when you were doing School of the Air?
No, I'm sure my parents thought I was rather obnoxious because they'd be putting all the calves down the calf pen, and I'd be down the back as a very small kid drafting all the ones off that I wanted to keep as bulls, and when they went and cut them all, I was rather annoyed. But yeah, they were a mob of brindles and blacks back then. So I was always very passionate about my cattle.
I think he was destined to be a bull breeder and a bull seller, which is what has come to fruition.
Yeah, it sounds like it. It's been something inspired from a very young age.
Definitely.
Yeah. So the two of you eventually met at camp drafting. Is that right?
Yes, we did. We met at Polythanga Camp Draft, which is just outside Charters Towers. So Mac would have been 18 and I would have been 21, I think.
Now, you have to tell me, was you, just for those who don't know what camp drafting is, would you mind just explaining for those that live in cities and have never been to a camp draft before?
Take it away,
yeah. So camp drafting, they call it Australia's own horse sport. So it's a bit of a mixture between rodeo and cutting, I suppose. So we have a small yard of cattle, around about 10 head in them, and that yard's around about 90 feet long, and we go in there and pick one of the 10 head, and we've got to take it up the front of that small yard and show the judge how our horse can block it for three or four turns, and then take it outside into a big arena and run it round some pegs in a clover leaf pattern and through a gateway of pegs, which is usually about 8 to 10 meters wide, and we have to get that done within 40 seconds. And there's a judge sitting there scoring us on how our horse works and our course points, yeah.
Camp drafting was derived from what they did every day. You know, before they would draft cattle through a set of cattle yards, they would cut out a beast, at, you know, in a big yard and get it outside. And that it's derived from what our ancestors would do every day.
Hmm. So I presume then that you've got a quite extensive, for both of you to be involved in camp drafting, that you really are quite skilled with the horse and manoeuvring in such a sort of small space.
I could lie and say that I'm extremely skilled, but Gail's probably more of a horse person than I am, but I'm probably firstly a cattleman that loves riding horses and trains them just enough to get the job done.
Yeah.
Because mainly we put so much of our time into improving the property, and to really train a horse properly takes a huge amount of man hours. But yeah, mm-hmm. Gail was certainly more of a horseman than I was. But yeah, we have a lot of fun with them.
We'll skip past the whole love story and everything else. You ended up then at the current property that you're on now. Was that something that was already within the family, or was that something that you bought together?
No. So we were married in 99 and we moved here in the year 2000. So It was purchased by my father about a year after we got married. So we moved here and managed it for him until 2014. He separated everything up and we became the official owners.
That's great. And it's called Cantor Park, is that
Cantor
right?
Cantor Park, that's correct.
Cantor Park. And could you describe what Cantor Park is, like what the landscape looks like?
28,000 acres or 11,500 hectares in the modern way. We range from river frontage. We have 12 kilometres of the Sutter River frontage, but it doesn't hold any permanent water. It's a dry river unless in flood. That has very good soil types down there from flooding out over the years with silt and whatnot. So that's our better country for fattening. And then we go up into Bendy and then out the back further forest country, which is where we breed all our calves. So it does deteriorate into a bit lower quality breeder country out the back, but we have to do our best to manage with what we've got and have to put out a lot of lick and whatnot each year. But we have spent a lot of money improving our pastures and doing everything we can to get better grass types and legumes in there, which has helped our carrying capacity enormously. But it's just a matter of managing the country we've got because it ranges from very fertile to quite poor. So we've sort of got a real cross-section of country.
I'd say it's predominantly flat with some rolling type hills. There's a few sort of little jump ups or ranges, but they're all only very low. You wouldn't call it hilly by any means.
And how do you manage the stock over such a vast property? I've talked to or interviewed many who use helicopters, motorbikes, horses, like utes, you name it. So how do you manage and move stock around?
Yeah, we're all horses, a motorbike occasionally, but pretty much all horses. We don't use the helicopter at all, and it's good for your cattle. We've got it set up that we've got a laneway from one end to the other, so and split all our paddocks up so Mac and I can actually pretty much muster any paddock on our own and get them into a lane and walk them to the yard. And where we grew up north, even though it was a huge rambling place, we didn't use helicopters either. It was all horses. So, yeah, that's how we grew up doing it and, yeah, that's how we've continued to do it.
As I mentioned earlier, this podcast has been made possible with the support of Isuzu Ute Australia. Having reliable vehicles is imperative in the harsh Australian outback, and Isuzu have provided D-Max Utes and MUX SUVs to pull seven large RFDS flight simulators as they engage in school, community and field day activities for the Royal Flying Doctor Service. These simulators are full-size planes, minus the wings, and the Isuzu D-Max and MUX vehicles are a perfect match for the long-distance heavy towing demands of these RFDS simulators right across Australia. So keep an eye out for them as they travel around each state, and we would love to see photos and locations on our Flying Doctor podcast community Facebook page when you see them. All right, well, wouldn't mind telling me now about the day of the accident. So when was it that happened?
9th of August 2002 was the day of my accident. We got up and had breakfast that morning early because we were building a fence around our garden. And, yeah, just the accident happened about 7:30, and despite that, I don't remember anything of that day. I don't remember having breakfast or anything, but Mac was on the tractor and I was at the back shoveling the dirt away from the auger, from the post hole digger. And, yeah, that's when our lives changed forever in about 1.5 seconds.
1 second. Mac, would you mind just briefly, without going into too much detail, what actually occurred?
Yes, all these sorts of things all have a bit of a chain of events connected to them, but where there was a garden bed when we came here, so it was a bit of a risen up garden bed with some old railway sleepers along the edge, so we were backed up to that drilling holes for the garden fence, and because Gail didn't want to stand up in the garden bed, she was sort of off to the side more than she would normally be. And the ironic part of it, she had a pair of leather gloves on, so-called safety gloves, and unfortunately, we don't really know what happened, whether she missed the dirt with a shovel and sort of overbalanced and the hands went in a bit closer than normal, and a latch pin on the drive shaft to the auger caught the back of a glove and jerked her into the drive shaft of the post hole digger, which spins, you know, 9 times a second or something. So it was a horrendous sight that I'll never forget, and can't believe she lived through it. But, yeah, it certainly changed their lives forever.
And at that point, I presume it was everything just to get the motor turned off and to figure out how to get her to a safe place, into the house or something?
That's right. She was so wrapped up around the drive shaft, and to be honest, I couldn't tell if she was alive or not because she was unconscious at the time. So I raced over and I think I just acknowledged, let the person know that was helping us that we had a major accident, and I raced straight inside to dial 000. And by the time I'd sort of got through to the operator and started telling them directions and what had happened, Adam Griffin, who was with us at the time, came inside and took over the phone call. And I went back outside to the tractor and Gail was gone, and Adam had actually carried her into the bed to a spare room outside. And at this stage I didn't realise that she'd lost her arm, but she was saying that her arm was lying behind her back. And when I picked up the blanket that he had over her to see what was wrong with her arm, I was, faced with a big black hole in the side of her, which was certainly something I'll never forget as well.
Right. How was the blood stemmed so that she didn't just end up bleeding out?
So the veins had pulled out of Gail's arm, as bad as it is to sort of talk about it, but so they were actually, the veins were up to nearly a foot long, all wrapped up and twisted off, which is definitely probably the main reason why she didn't bleed out rapidly.
Wow.
And because it was such a twisting motion, how it pulled the shoulder blade and everything out. So I think that was the main, because it was half an hour before we had anyone else arrive, and our neighbours ended up coming over to help. And yeah, it was a miracle that she survived, that's for sure.
So was it a long time that you had to wait before emergency care came, because you are a long way away from anything?
Yeah, I can't remember exact time frames, but I think it was at least a bit over an hour before we had an ambulance. Might have been like an hour and a half, and then I think about 2 hours before we had helicopter and flying doctor.
And was Gail conscious or in and out of consciousness? Or
no, she regained consciousness straight away, and yeah, was conscious the whole time until they put her into an induced coma just before they put her on the plane.
Right, right. And you don't remember any of it, I'm sure, Gail, right?
I don't remember.
I'm glad you don't.
I'm glad too.
I'm really glad you don't. You don't need that.
And just in regard with the bleeding, the flying doctor were just amazing. So they all sort of arrived at about the two-hour mark, and they, as Max said, put me in an induced coma, and they did a bit of an operation on my arm right there and then to stop the bleeding as much as they could. And then once I was on the plane, we were meant to go to Brisbane, and before takeoff they decided that we needed to go to Townsville because we needed to go to the shortest route, because I had compound fracture to my femur. And I had no blood getting to my lower leg, so they made the decision to go to Townsville, and they actually did a little procedure in air where they opened up my groin and moved blood past my broken femur into my lower leg so that I didn't lose my leg. It's quite incredible what they can do.
Wow. Wow. Okay. And did you go on the plane, Mac, or were you waiting behind?
No, I stayed and went to Townsville with Gail's father, Alan.
Right.
Which was a horrible trip because it was, mobile phones were only very new then, and we sort of really had no contact for the 4 hours that it took us to get to Townsville and didn't really know whether she'd survived the trip or not.
Yeah, that's horrible. So, okay, well, once you actually got to the hospital and they were able to assess you, did they decide that you needed more surgery?
Yeah, so as soon as I got to Townsville, I obviously went in for emergency surgery for not only the amputated arm and shoulder blade and everything gone, but I had so many other breaks, so compound fracture to my femur, and then my arm was shattered top and bottom. So they were the initial things. They patched me up early on, and I spent 3 weeks in Townsville in high dependency. Well, the first week was in ICU and then probably 2 weeks in high dependency. And the weird part for me is, and I guess back then I was so unwell and everything's a bit of a blur, but I knew my left arm was completely shattered, but it just never dawned on me that I couldn't move it at all. They didn't talk about that at all in the early days. They didn't want to add to, nobody really told me that was what was going on. But, yeah, look, those first few weeks were pretty horrific from looking back, getting me from the bed to even a bed to bath me. They'd put me in a giant big sling because I'd done a lot of damage to my neck as well, where the nerves had all pulled out, and it was quite horrific, some of those memories. But towards the end of that 3 weeks, when I found out about my left arm being paralysed, they sent me for nerve conduction studies where they stick these horrible big needles in your neck and read the amount of reaction that they're getting out of those nerves. And that's when they basically told me that they were all pulled out of the spinal cord, and they said, go home and learn to live with it. And, you know, I was in hospital preparing for a life with one arm, but it's quite obviously more traumatic thought to think of no arms. And it was really only my family that delved a little bit deeper and investigated what other options and avenues we might have for surgery for my particular type of injury. And that's what eventually got us to Sydney through the help of a surgeon in Townsville. And yeah, we got onto a guy in Sydney that was doing, you know, operations on nerves for brachial plexus injuries like mine, which really no one else was doing. And it was all a bit of a gamble, you know, you didn't know what results you were going to get, but it was all worth, you know, there was nothing to lose.
Yeah. How were you coping during all of this, Mac?
Not well at times, but, you know, my family and Gail's family are all so close, such good friends, and we all gathered round. And it wasn't until about probably a week into it that the doctors really came to us and said, unfortunately, we're nearly sure Gail's left arm is completely paralysed, because MRI scans are showing that all the nerves have torn out of her neck, which was ironic because the arm that was pulled off, all the nerves were still attached. So that was definitely, as much as it was going on, that was the hardest thing. That really shook us. I remember Gail's sisters and I on the floor in a real state when we found that out, and not for ourselves but just for Gail, because you know, one arm, you can virtually live a complete independent life, but with no arms, you know it's going to be extremely life-changing. So, yeah, that was the hardest point. But once we got past that, and like Gail said, we got some information about Sydney, and we were sort of able to aim our sights on that, and through the great help of the Flying Doctor to take Gail and myself from Townsville to Sydney, was a huge stepping stone in our journey.
Mm. I'm just thinking, like, it takes such great resolve and courage in such a circumstance, and it's quite easy to become bleak and dark about it all. I did an interview some time ago now with a man who had his arm amputated, and he said, you can either just lie down and give up, or you can say, no, there's a way, and the way is forward. Did you both use each other as support and find methods or ways of coping with that stress and with the major changes, yeah, without it becoming too bleak and dark?
Yes, I think so. And I think a lot of that we've got to thank is not only for me, Mac, but also our families. Both sides were there. My mum was there every single day of my 3 months in hospital, and family rotated the whole time to be with me and her and Mac. And look, yes, you know, I feel like we handled it incredibly well for the earth-shattering news that it was at the time. It was something that we just decided we just had to make it work and go on from. And you know, that story you're mentioning about the guy you interviewed, I call it the sink or swim. You know, you make a choice, and whether you're going to have a crack at making what you've got work, or you know, think it's all too hard. And I think it's that survival instinct in us that we don't want to lie down and quit, and yeah, still just striving to get back to where we love being and what we love doing. And ultimately, for us, amazingly, we were able to do that.
That's fantastic. That's really good. Now, as you were in recovery, was there a lot of pain? Did you end up having, you know, that phantom pain and so forth that happens when you've got a limb that's no longer there?
Yeah, so in Townsville, it was all about the phantom pain of the amputated side, and I really didn't get any nerve or neuropathic pain in my paralysed arm, but they were very... very definite in telling me that it would happen and it would start about 3 weeks after my accident, and they call it neuropathic pain associated with brachial plexus injuries when you tear the nerve out of the spinal cord. And they kind of described it in a simple way to me that you unplug the nerve out of the nerve root in the spinal cord, and the nerve root just sends a constant signal to the brain, a pain signal saying something's wrong. And what I could never quite understand is why it doesn't happen straight away. They knew it was coming, and they knew it would take a couple of weeks, and they actually trialled some drugs in that lead up to that 2-3 week mark. In Townsville, I had some drugs they'd never tried before. They actually collapsed my lungs, overdosing me on one of the particular drugs.
Oh, my gosh.
But unfortunately, they were right, and around that time when I moved to Sydney, that pain began in my paralysed arm, and that made the phantom pain really not an issue at all. It was, and it's still to this day, it is one of the biggest stumbling blocks for me. It's can be unbearable at times. It's something, that I never knew existed. I didn't think people that had paralysed limbs felt pain in those paralysed limbs, but unfortunately it's a world I didn't even know existed.
So that becomes now chronic pain that you have to manage on a daily basis moving forward? Like there's no, is there no resolution or no medical clinical way for them to address it, or is it just something you have to deal with?
No, so opioids and morphine and those things don't help it whatsoever, because it's nerve pain. So right from the start they prescribed me with epileptic medication, actually, because it kind of dulls the nerve senses. And that's what I've been on ever since, and look, it really does help, but it certainly doesn't take it away. And there are times different things make it a lot worse. Humidity is one of them. You know, when it's really humid, it really gets bad, and I go through times when it's really gives me hell for a week or so, and other times, you know, when I'm busy and can distract myself, that's probably the best thing for it. But unfortunately for sleeping and those things, once you turn the light off and turn the telly off, it sort of rears its ugly head. But yeah, there's really no other things they can do for me. There are people that have had an operation where they burn the nerve root, but it doesn't last forever, and it comes back and can often come back worse than it was initially.
Oh my gosh.
But the problem being is because the five nerves are pulled out, there's no landmarks for them where to burn. And so if they burn too far one way, you can lose functionality of your legs and proprioception of your legs and things that I couldn't risk doing.
Wow. Okay. Would you mind telling me just a little bit about your everyday life? Because both you, Gail, and Mac have really adapted everyday activities to be able to manage with not having the use of your arms, or not having one arm and then not having use of the other. So could you tell me just a few of the things that you've become quite innovative around, and how that's managed to still enable you to carry on doing what you love?
Yeah, so a regular day for me, I guess it depends on what we're doing, but I usually go out with Mac in the morning when he heads out for the day to the shed. I jump on my buggy, which is not modified, and drive with my feet on the wheel, and I go down and check the mares and foals every morning and do a little inspection of the bulls and the mares and whatever's close. And, yes, depends what we're doing. If we're mustering, we're out. We're straight down to the cattle yard and drafting every morning, and Max helped me with modifications in the cattle yard, putting things on slide gates so I can open and shut them with my feet, and branding, same thing. I bring all the carbs up the race when they're on the branding cradle. Yes, and then if for the mustering part, I'm on my buggy and I usually zoom around the longest route of the paddock to check while they're all trotting out on their horses. But not if we're not mustering, I do all the books, so I spend a lot of time in the office. I've got a big giant keyboard on the floor, which is actually for people with vision impairments, and a big old-fashioned rollerball mouse all on the floor. So, yeah, I do all the books, and because we have stud cattle and breed, you know, our stallion's quite popular and gets lots of mares, there's lots of book work to do with all that stuff and registering cattle and whatnot. So, yeah, it keeps me pretty busy in the office. But at the moment today we've been putting in new gateways and doing some fencing. So Mac and myself and Shani, that's helping us for the day, have been out helping him. He's welding and, yeah, I'm doing whatever I can to kick things here and there and stand on things and hold things. So today it's fencing.
That's great. That's great. And how about you, Mac? Is life just a new normal for you? Is it just a constant? I sort of get the idea as we've been talking and learning a little bit about you that you're constantly looking for ways that you can help Gail with her independence. And yeah, there's a bit of an innovative brain there that seems to be always at work. Am I right?
Oh, no, I don't know
yes,
about that. But,
you're right.
Look, no, it's, you know, obviously our days are just extended by an hour or two, probably on top of everyone else's days, because we, you know, there's just extra time every in the mornings to, you know, to help, used to be able to just probably set your alarm for, you know, 15, 20 minutes before you want to tell everyone to start work. But now it's an hour and 15. So it all, you know, time adds up when you've got to do two of everything and help Gail with breakfast and sort of set her up before you head out the door if she's not coming with you. So, yeah, every and then night's the same, you know. Everyone sort of probably right at bedtime, everyone heads off to bed, but we've sort of probably still got another half an hour or 45 minutes of bits and pieces. So the days are definitely lengthened as a carer and as a couple. But, yeah, look, like we've been saying the whole way through, it was our choice to stay out where we are and not have a carer as such. So it was something I was more than happy to take on, and it gave us the ability to still lead an independent couple's life.
Mm. Has it brought you closer together?
Yeah, well, we certainly don't spend much time apart. Mac would go on an annual father-son fishing trip with a group. It was probably about the only time we were apart all year, but that doesn't happen quite so much anymore. But, yes, we do not spend much time apart. Working together inside and out is what we had always hoped and dreamed our life would be, and that's still what it is.
Yeah. What do you envision for the future?
Yeah, well, I don't like to think too far down the track because I know as I get older and this body gets less and less flexible and more sore, my life may become a little more difficult. But, look, we will push on here for as long as both of us, our bodies hold up, I guess. I think it'll take a fair bit to dig us both out of here. And then when that all becomes too hard, well, we'll deal with that part of our life then. We try not to focus too much on it. We do think about where we should retire and should we think about, you know, buying a little block somewhere in an area where we want to retire, because inevitably I may need help, either substituting Mac's help or whatever happens in the future. But, yeah, we just think about that every now and again, but it's something we haven't acted upon yet.
I can't imagine you, though, being somewhere that is not surrounded by either the landscape or the animals that you love. Like, I can't imagine you ending up at the Gold Coast or something,
no,
you know.
No. definitely no Gold Coast. And if our parents are anything to go by, they, yeah, you know, you want to be out here in this environment for as long as possible. My beautiful mum had to move to town when she injured herself after a number of times off a four-wheeler, and sold her block of land and her cattle and moved into town, and she really has never lived in town before and does not enjoy living in town at all. It's, yeah, when it's in your blood, you don't want to make that move to, you know, you want to be remote and rural pretty much till the end.
Yeah, yeah. I live on a rural property and I've already said to my man, look, I'm going to die here. I'm not leaving. Yeah. you'll have to take me out by force. I'm not leaving.
Yeah.
Do you think there's any reflections or life lessons that you'd like to share with those that are listening about what you've been through and about your current day-to-day life and, yeah, just the challenges but also the learnings?
I would say the biggest thing is to make sure that you 100% respect your partner, you know. I guess, like you touched on before, Hollywood's all about love stories and this and that, but, you know, love gets you so far, but then respect has to get you over the line because, you know, we all know whether you have a normal life and no injuries and kids and ups and downs and financial issues and everything, people, you know, there's times that are tough and arguments happen and whatnot, but respect's the only thing that'll push through that. If you're just hoping for some romantic love to hold you together, I think that's a bit of a Hollywood myth. So I would just, if I was to try and push anything out there, is respect your partner every bit as much as you love them, and that will hold you in good stead.
That's wonderful advice. And you go?
And, yeah, look, I would say you need to do what you love. If you're doing what you love every day, you'll never work another day in your life, they say. And, I mean, that's what we've done. And in hospital, the dream was to get back home to doing what we loved. And although I couldn't ride the horses and break young ones in and do all those things I used to do, and we still have a fulfilling life. I mean, we're still doing what we love, breeding beautiful cattle and horses. And so it's making the decision to make the best of what you got and be thankful for the people that are around you. And for me, family was a huge part of it. We saw lots of people in hospital that had absolutely no family or support whatsoever, and it really shines a light on how valuable that is. And, I mean, I had someone in my room every single day of the 3 months, and that was amazing for my family and Max's family to uproot themselves and give up their life during our dark hour.
Mm.
But I guess that's what families do, and we were so lucky to have that.
Mm-hmm. That's so true. Listen, thank you so much, both of you, for being able to come and have a little chat with us. Is there anything else you'd like to share before we go?
Lana, I'd just like to say that I've had a long association with the Royal Flying Doctor, and Mac has too. And when I was a child, we had Flying Doctor clinics every 3 months at Valley of Lagoons on the property where I grew up, and we had a room that was called the Flying Doctor Room, and that's where all the clinics took place. And so it was a very big part of our life. And then many times the Flying Doctor came to us with injuries, with people on the property that got hurt. We used to have to go down and hunt the stud cows off the strip. And if it was dark, we had all Sunshine Milk powdered tins in the carport full of sand, and we'd go down and put them up either side of the strip and fill them up with kerosene and light them at night, and that was the lights that they used. And look, the Flying Doctor's been a huge part of our life, and I put up the Royal Flying Doctor to be a charity that my charity group, the Classic Ladies Foundation, raised money for last year, and we very proudly raised a very large sum of money, about $75,000, for the Flying Doctor. And Mac and I had the honour of going to the Flying Doctor base in Dubbo.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah, we went and handed over the big cheque and saw that wonderful exhibit that you've got down there. I thought it was amazing, and I'm really honoured to go there. But, yeah, look, for me, Flying Doctor is a huge part of everybody's life. And I made a speech at our huge horse event in Tamworth, and I spoke in front of a couple of thousand people and told the story of how the Flying Doctor came to be. And Yeah, it's something that I'm very passionate about, and we grew up with the old Flying Doctor kit, and it got pulled on many times.
That's fantastic. Thank you so much for all the support and the fundraising and everything else. It's been an absolute pleasure to be able to support you when you needed it.
Thank you, Lana. Yes, and look, rural Australia would be lost without the Royal Flying Doctor, because helicopters and all those things are amazing, but they can't go long distances like the plane can. So it's saved many, many, many lives in rural Australia, and that's why we're both so passionate about constantly fundraising for such a vital service.
Thank you so much again.
Thank you.
Thank you, Lana. Lovely to speak to you.
Thanks for listening. Word of mouth is always the best promotion for a podcast. So if you enjoy this podcast or a specific story, please share it with family and friends. If you haven't already, join our Facebook group called the Flying Doctor Podcast Community. And you can also send feedback, questions or comments to me directly at lana.mitchell@rfds.org.au. Donations to support the Royal Flying Doctor Service can always be made through our website at flyingdoctor.org.au. The Flying Doctor Podcast was presented by me, Lana Mitchell, and senior producer is Mandy Coolan. Before I head off, I just want to thank one last time our sponsor and major national partner, Isuzu Ute Australia. Isuzu is committed to supporting the communities in which the RFDS operates, and this podcast would not be possible without their support. To learn more, search Isuzu Ute online.